This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb, my co-host, but he's also the interviewee of the day because he has a new artistic project going that is very exciting, and everybody that's been involved has just really loved being involved. It's coming at us from probably a direction that no one saw coming, except for it's been dear to his heart for his entire creative life, Samuel Beckett and the play Waiting for Godot, and he has made a film based on whatever. How did this come about? How did this happen?
Well, it's funny. The way it all started was a good friend of mine sent me an article in a literary journal about essentially why you can't make a movie of Waiting for Godot. And of course, in it, you can make a movie of any play if you just go to the theater and point a camera at the stage while they're doing the play. But I think what they were really referring to was the idea of making Waiting for Godot as a movie. And as everyone knows, even, you know, making plays out of Shakespeare, making movies out of Shakespeare plays is quite a challenge because it's such a different medium, and the script doesn't necessarily work that way, and the dramatic elements of a stage play are just terribly different from the dramatic elements and the vocabulary of cinematography. So anyway, I read this article, and although I more or less agree that you can't convert a play like Godot into a movie, I completely disagreed with the description of the author, with his rationale. He seemed to have completely missed the point of the play. And Waiting for Godot is a pretty well-known play. It's considered by many to be the most influential play of the 20th century. It's also considered to be the first of the, shall we say, theater of the absurd, although that term is a bit restrictive. Beckett was not into the absurd. He definitely responded to the ironies of human life, that we should be given such perception and such insight and yet not be given access, apparently, to the answers, to the questions that inevitably come up. And that irony, or tragedy, if you will, is a central fascination throughout all of Beckett's work. And he wrote lots of poems, quite a few novels, quite a few plays, and lots of essays, and was active even in film and television productions towards the end of his life. He was born 3 years after my father in 1906, and he died in 1989. So he had 86 years of time to do things, and he did quite a lot of things. Very few people... Well, before I go into Beckett, let me just explain more about this project. It's easy to get distracted when I'm talking about Beckett. So anyway, I was thinking about, you know, you can't make a movie of Waiting for Godot. And I had performed in Waiting for Godot back in the 60s in a repertory company in Vermont connected with Goddard College. And our production was rather intense. We spent 6 weeks rehearsing, so we knew the play inside out, backwards and forwards. Each character knew all the lines of all the other characters. And we put a lot of depth into it for college students, and I think it was a pretty successful production. And I fell in love with what he was doing. If it's something you can fall in love with, as it's somewhat tragic. But it's also funny, and that's the curious thing about the play. So as I thought about this, I realized that although I didn't want to make a movie of Godot, I realized I had a very clear mental image of how I can see Godot now as an influence in my life rather than as someone else's play. And I wanted to try and express what Godot does for me when I think of it as a work of art. And the vision of this was, though faint, very, very clear and specific. And within a couple of days, I knew pretty much exactly what had to be done. So I collected a group of cast members around town and was very fortunate to get some really great people. We shot the thing on my single lens reflex camera, not as video, but as a series of about 250 still photographs, which I then worked on in Photoshop to give them a particular look. Then I edited it down to about 60 or 70 images and wrote a little string quartet background music for it, and put the whole thing together. And it runs about 10 minutes. The actual play of Waiting for Godot is about 2 hours long in most productions. So this isn't Waiting for Godot. If you don't know the play, what you'll see in this film is still something that I think somewhat expresses how I feel about this amazing work of art. And so that's where it came from. The name of the film is Threnody, which is a slightly obscure word in the same family as melody. But a threnody is usually a dirge or some kind of music played in a lamenting context. And the word comes from an amazingly eloquent paragraph written by a reviewer in the London Times in the 60s, shortly after the play came out. Unfortunately, although I've done quite a bit of hunting around online, I haven't been unable to find this original review. I've found lots of other reviews, but not the one that contains this quote. And I find that rather extraordinary. The quote does capture something of the play, and I think it's rather apropos. It says, "One of the most noble and moving plays of our generation, a threnody of hope deceived and deferred, but never extinguished, a play suffused with tenderness for the whole human perplexity, with phrases that come like a sharp stab of beauty and pain." And rather than try and give you a synopsis of what the play is all about, I would rather just talk a little bit more about what the play is trying to say, what Beckett's trying to say, who Beckett was. He was quite a remarkable person.
Well, let me just insert here for those who might have just tuned in that I'm interviewing my co-host today, who has produced this wonderful and incredible film with actors here in Fairfield, and he's written the music to go with it. It's quite a cool thing that he's created, Alan Cobb, on the called Threnody, and it's based on Samuel Beckett's it's based around Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot. So those of you who have been tuned in the whole time know this, but those who have just tuned in, I want to bring you up to speed. So go ahead.
Well, so...
This is why I actually interrupted. I want people to know that you will be talking on, and this is one of our inserts, so if this is a show is being repeated, disregard this, because sometimes we repeat shows later down the line just for their information.
Yeah, knowledge this show is airing just before the first Odd Thursday in December of 2010.
Right.
So next week, if you're hearing this at the very end of November in 2010, I'll be hosting ICON's regular Odd Thursday discussion, and I'm going to begin by showing this 10-minute film that I made, and then I'll talk in more detail, as much detail as people are interested in, about the play itself and about the man who wrote it. As I've mentioned, he's quite an extraordinary person. His Waiting for Godot is probably his most famous play. Some listeners may have heard of Endgame or Crap's Last Tape or Happy Days, which are really the other primarily full-length plays. He wrote, I forget the number, I think about 13 plays. Some of them are only, well, there's one that's called, I forget the name of it too, but there's one which I think is less than a minute long. At the end of the evening on Odd Thursday, I'm going to show a film of a play of Beckett's, which is in fact somewhat shorter than my film. The play itself, without any editing, is only about 7 minutes long. It's called Come and Go. And it has no words. And it's quite remarkable. And I think people will be surprised at how much can be done with three actresses, virtually nothing happening, no dialogue, and only 7 minutes on the stage. And if you could ever see it on the stage, I have to tell you, these things, like paintings, work very differently in the flesh, as it were, than they do in pictures. So a video of that play, as marvelous as it is 10% of the impact of actually seeing people doing it. It's really kind of astonishing to see these things. And many of his plays are less than 20 minutes long. So Waiting for Godot is really a play about two guys who are waiting for someone who apparently is named Godot. There's always been some discussion about how Godot is to be pronounced. And he actually went to the trouble of writing this play and much of his other work in French, although he's Irish, so that he wouldn't get bogged down in fancy literary style. He wanted to keep his expressions elemental and direct. And then after writing it in French, he translated it into English and actually edited it somewhat. The French version is a bit different in certain ways. And he began working on it a couple of years after I was born in 1948. It was published in 1952, and the premiere in Paris was in 1953. It also opened in Miami. I forget what year, I think maybe 56. It was a total flop in Miami, and it closed after a few days. Curiously, the one reason it was a total flop is that some publicist called it the laugh sensation of two continents. And those of you who know the play must be shocked to think that anyone could be so off base. It is a tragicomedy in two acts. That's its official subtitle. But it is not a laugh sensation. It is funny. There's no question about it. But watching two people passing the time while waiting for eternity by being funny is itself tragic. So they are funny, and the situation is tragic. And the mixture of the two is what makes this play so extraordinary. Because you laugh, and then you sort of wish you hadn't. Because you realize that you're laughing at yourself, and your situation isn't really fundamentally any better or any different than the situation of the characters. But from a more cosmic standpoint, there's a very interesting thing going on in Beckett's message. I mentioned earlier that this article about why you can't make a movie about this play had missed the point. And it's very rare that an author's message is written out in English inside the play. Admittedly, it's disguised and buried. But there's a character in the play named Lucky, who is a slave, who can, quote, think. And when asked to think, he begins this incredible sort of pseudo-scholarly diatribe. And it starts off at a rational pace, And then he becomes more and more excited until finally he's literally just flailing around screaming this thing, and it's become totally incoherent. And the only way they can get him to stop is by pulling off his hat. So he then stops, and Lucky remains silent for the rest of the play. But in this 3 pages without punctuation, if you read the play, and it's apart from that one speech, the play is eminently readable. Lots of people have trouble reading plays, and I don't blame them. But I highly recommend reading Waiting for Godot, because it's a very fast read. The lines are very short, and it's mostly two people having a almost vaudevillian dialogue. But buried in that 3 pages of absolute verbal garbage is a tiny thread of syntax, which says, and I quote, "Given the existence of a personal God outside of time without extension, man wastes and pines, wastes and pines." And I think that this is one of the most transcendental observations that any literary artist has ever made, at least in the 20th century. The point is that we all know what he's referring to. We all would sort of like to know, where is God? Why isn't it more obvious? Isn't he going to ever show himself to us? And how can we possibly make any sense out of anything if he exists, but we can't find him? And this is the perplexity of the human situation that Times of London reviewer refers to, and it's a fundamental problem. And then what Beckett shows us in this play is that you really only have 2 choices for dealing with that conundrum. One is what the 2 main characters are doing, which is waiting. They're waiting for Godot, and they don't know that he's coming. They, at the end of each act, a little kid arrives who says that he is coming, but there's no guarantee. Each time the kid comes, he says he's not coming today, but surely tomorrow. And so there's this fundamental question about waiting. You know, waiting might not work. It might not be the right thing to do. And so they wish there were something else they could do. And what we see them doing in their repartee with each other to pass the time, to cheer us up, to calm us down, is exploring the alternatives. And there really aren't very many alternatives. The only one they ever do come up with is, well, there are 2, really. One is they could kill themselves, but that one of them would have to do it first with the help of the other, and that would leave the other one alone. And they don't have the heart to leave either one of each other alone. And they don't really have the motivation to do something that drastic anyway. And the last line of the play is that one of them looks at the other and says, "Let's go." And the other one says, "Yes, let's go." And the stage direction following that is they do not move. And I'm reminded of one of Beckett's novels. I think my favorite of his novels is this trilogy, Molloy, Malone Dies, and The Unnameable. And the very end of The Unnameable, I think it's the very end, I could be misremembering, it might be the very beginning. The narrator says, "I can't go on. I must go on. No, sorry, it's the other way around. I'm butchering this. I must go on. I can't go on. I'll go on." So that's the other alternative. And in Waiting for Godot, we have 2 other characters. There are only 4 characters besides the boy. And these other 2 characters come on in the middle of each act and interact with the main characters a little bit and then go on. And we find that explicitly that is, in fact, what they do. They go on. And that's the other choice. You can wait or you can go on. But unfortunately, neither of them achieves much because God is outside of time and can't be found. And man fundamentally wastes and pines. So it's almost an indictment of creation. It's Beckett saying, come on, if you're going to set this thing up, give us the next step. And of course, for many of us, that next step is consciousness. It's discovering the self beneath all this weird superficial behavior that Beckett illustrates so eloquently. There is something else. It's the heart that you see in Beckett's plays, which is so memorable. It's why you actually care about these crazy characters. Their situation is our situation, and you have to care about them. But at the same time, it's that sensitivity that Beckett is showing us there is something more here. It's in the way these characters are trying, are striving, are determined. And it's not presented in the classical sense of triumph over adversity. There is no triumph. Nothing happens. Nothing is accomplished. There is nothing to be done, which, of course, is the opening line of Waiting for Godot. But that shows, I think, Beckett's intuition that there is an answer, and the answer is somehow inside. He just doesn't know how to find it. He doesn't know where to look. And of course, the ultimate irony is that it's inside everyone, and you don't need to know where to look. You really only need to know to look, and at least the direction. But so to me, this play is a profound cosmic statement, which is not really an indictment of creation as much as it is an indictment of the present human condition. And given the possibility that the human condition doesn't have to be completely blind to the self, then Beckett's problem is nicely resolved. And we still marvel at the way it works, because even with self-realization, we still see people acting out the rest of the play. And it's just that now the play has an audience, instead of the characters being stuck forever as characters inside the play. So Samuel Beckett, there's only a few minutes left. I should mention that he fought in the French resistance during the Second World War. He moved to France specifically to join the resistance and fight the Nazis. And after a few years of doing that and having established a bit of a reputation for himself, a counter spy in his resistance unit in 1942 turned him into the Nazis. And he and his girlfriend at the time, I'm not sure if they were married yet, moved to a tiny village in the Alps and stayed there doing a certain amount of coordinating and storing supplies and things for the resistance, but he basically stayed out of sight for the remainder of the war. And during that time, he wrote his I think it was his first novel, Watt, which he began right at the beginning of the war and then finished it in 45. He was from Dublin. He returned there after being in France, and he was from a middle-class family. He wasn't a starving artist, but his family expected him to have a more conventional career than that of a writer. And after his return to Dublin, he had a bit of a falling out with his family and moved back to France and lived there primarily for the rest of his life. So a lot of his works were written in French, and he had a very, very strong reputation in France. He worked and was a good friend of James Joyce, worked with him and corresponded in depth. I think he's much more accessible than James Joyce. But at the same time, there's a curious inner vision that's very much common to Joyce. Maybe it may be common to the Irish character as well. He got the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1969. As I understood it, he declined the prize at first, and his friends convinced him that wasn't the best thing to do. So he accepted the prize and set up a foundation for starving Irish writers, and didn't take any of the money for himself. He was very particular about the production of his works. He was opposed to experimental variations on his stage directions and things. He wanted them to be done exactly the way he wrote them. And when you see this very short play at the end this coming Thursday, if it's the year 2010, you'll see how precisely his stage works are put together, and why, if in fact he uses the same degree of precision for a two-hour production like Godot, why he would be so particular about doing it the right way. The thing is, the play works incredibly well. It works so well that high school companies can produce it, and it will still have an impact. There have been lots of productions of it. Nathan Lane and a few others were in it. John Goodman and one or two, I forget the other two actors, were in it, I think, last year on Broadway. And I'm not sure I would have cast it quite that way, but it's very accessible, and there are many different ways of seeing it through the eyes of the actors. The language in it is so open that it leaves a lot of room for actors to do things even while following the directions to the letter. Well, we only have about 20 seconds. I've dominated.
Well, thank you. No, this is what I wanted everyone to hear about it. And if you are hearing this the first time around in 2010, then come out Thursday to Odd Thursday and watch the film that Alan made and this short film by Beckett, and hear more of this, or bring your questions and hear more.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.